We are all strands in a long rope that stretches back countless generations and ties together every person in every country on every continent. We are all thinking and feeling the same things. We are all made of and motivated by the same things. We are all stardust. And no one needs this understanding more than the ambitious or the creative, since they live so much in their own heads and in their own bubble. Finding the universal in the personal and the personal in the universal is not only the secret to art and leadership and even entrepreneurship, it is the secret to centering oneself. It both turns down the volume of noise in the world and tunes one in to the quiet wavelength of wisdom that sages and philosophers have long been on. This connectedness and universality does not need to stop at our fellow man. The philosopher Martha Nussbaum recently pointed out the narcissism of the human obsession with what it means to be human. A better, more open, more vulnerable, more connected question to ask is, what does it mean to be alive or to exist, period? As she wrote, "We share a planet with billions of other sentient beings, and they all have their own complex ways of being whatever they are. All of our fellow animal creatures, as Aristotle observed long ago, try to stay alive and reproduce more of their kind. All of them perceive, all of them desire, and most move from place to place to get what they want and need. We share much of our DNA with these creatures. We breathe the same air, we walk on the same land, and swim in the same oceans. We are inextricably intertwined with each other, as are our fates. The less we are convinced of our exceptionalism, the greater ability we have to understand and contribute to our environment. The less blindly driven we are by our own needs, the more clearly we can appreciate the needs of those around us, the more we can appreciate the larger ecosystem of which we are a part. Peace is when we realize that victory and defeat are almost always identical spots on one long spectrum. Peace is what allows us to take joy in the success of others and let them take joy in our own. Peace is what motivates a person to be good, to treat every other living thing well, because it understands that it is a way to treat themselves well. We are one big collective organism engaged in one endless project together. We are one. We are the same. Still, too often we forget it, and we forget ourselves in the process. On to what's next. Very few go astray who comport themselves with restraint. Confucius. What's essential is invisible to the eye. The quote that hung on Fred Rogers' wall was actually only a partial quote. The rest appears in The Little Prince, the beautiful and surreal children's book by the French aviator and World War II hero Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. In it, the fox tells the little boy, "Here's my secret. It's very simple. It's only with the heart that one can see rightly. What's essential is invisible to the eye." First, we sought mental clarity, but we quickly realized that the soul must be in equally good order if we wish to achieve stillness. In concert with each other, clarity in the mind and in the soul, we find both excellence and unbreakable tranquility. It is with the heart and the soul that we are able to surface important things that the eyes need to see. Examining our souls is not as easy as clearing our minds, you'll find. It requires that we peel back what the writer Mark Manson has called the self-awareness onion and take responsibility for our own emotions and impulses. Anyone who's done it can tell you that tears and onions often go together. It's precisely this soft stuff, getting in touch with ourselves, finding balance and meaning, cultivating virtue, that the volleyball champion Kerry Walsh Jennings has said makes her such a killer on the court. Some ancient traditions have held that the soul is in the belly, which is fitting for two reasons. Because we've just been through the belly of the beast part of our journey, and because it sets up where we go next. Stillness isn't merely an abstraction, something we only think about or feel. It's also real. It's in our bodies. Seneca warned us not to suppose that the soul is at peace when the body is still, vice versa. Lao Tzu said that movement is the foundation of stillness. What follows then is the final domain of stillness, the literal form that our form takes in the course of day-to-day life. Our bodies, where, you must not forget, the heart and the brain are both located, the environment we put those bodies in, the habits and routine to which we subject that body. A body that is overworked or abused is not actually still. It creates turbulence that ripples through the rest of our lives. A mind that is overtaxed and ill-treated is susceptible to vice and corruption. A spoiled, lazy existence is the manifestation of spiritual emptiness. We can be active, we can be on the move, and still be still. Indeed, we have to be active for the stillness to have any meaning. Life is hard, fortune is fickle, we can't afford to be weak, we can't afford to be fragile. We must strengthen our bodies as the physical vessel for our minds and spirit, subject to the capriciousness of the physical world, which is why we now move on to this final domain of stillness, the body and its place in the real world, in real life. Part 3, Body. We are all sculptors and painters, and our material is our own flesh and blood and bones. Henry David Thoreau. The domain of the body. Winston Churchill had a productive life. He first saw combat at age 21 and wrote his first best-selling book about it not long after. By 26, he'd been elected to public office and would serve in government for the next 6.5 decades. He'd write some 10 million words and over 40 books, paint more than 500 paintings, and give some 2,300 speeches in the course of his time on the planet. And in between all that, he managed to hold the positions of Minister of Defense, First Lord of the Admiralty, Chancellor of the Exchequer, and of course, Prime Minister of Britain, where he helped save the world from the Nazi menace. And then, to top it all off, he spent his twilight years fighting the totalitarian communist menace. It is a pushing age, Churchill wrote to his mother as a young man, and we must shove with the rest. It may well be that Winston Churchill was the greatest pusher in all of history. His life spanned the final cavalry charge of the British Empire, which he witnessed as a young war correspondent in 1898, and ended well into the nuclear age, indeed the space age, both of which he helped usher in. His first trip to America was on a steamship, to be introduced on stage by Mark Twain, no less, and his final one on a Boeing 707 that flew at 500 miles per hour. In between, he saw two world wars, the invention of the car, radio, and rock and roll, and countless trials and triumphs. Is there stillness to be found here? Could someone that active, so Herculean in their labors, who embraced so much strife and stress, ever be described as still or at peace? Strangely, yes. As Paul Johnson, one of Churchill's best biographers, would write, the balance he maintained between flat-out work and creative and restorative leisure is worth study by anyone holding a top position. Johnson, as a 17-year-old, decades before his own career as a writer, met Churchill on the street and shouted to him, "Sir, to what do you attribute your success in life?" Immediately, Churchill replied, "Conservation of energy. Never stand up when you can sit down. Never sit down when you can lie down." Churchill conserved his energy so that he never shirked from a task or backed down from a challenge, so that for all his work and pushing, he never burned himself out or snuffed out the spark of joy that made life worth living. Indeed, in addition to the importance of hard work, Johnson said that the four other lessons from Churchill's remarkable life were to aim high, to never allow mistakes or criticism to get you down, to waste no energy on grudges, duplicity, or infighting, and to make room for joy. Even during the war, Churchill never lost his sense of humor, never lost sight of what was beautiful in the world, and never became jaded or cynical. Different traditions offer different prescriptions for the good life. The Stoics urged determination and iron self-will. The Epicureans preached relaxation and simple pleasures. The Christians spoke of saving mankind and glorifying God. The French a certain joie de vivre, the happiness and most resilient of us managed to incorporate a little of each of these approaches into our lives. And that was certainly true of Churchill. He was a man of great discipline and passion. He was a soldier. He was a lover of books, a believer in glory and honor, a statesman, a literal bricklayer, and a painter. We are all worms, he once joked to a friend, simple organisms that eat and defecate and then die, but he liked to think of himself as a glowworm. In addition to his impressive mental abilities and spiritual strength, Churchill was also an unexpected, given his portly frame, master of the third and final domain of stillness, the physical one. Few would have predicted he would distinguish himself there. Born with a frail constitution, Churchill complained as a young man that he was cursed with so feeble a body that I can hardly support the fatigues of the day. Yet like Theodore Roosevelt before him, he cultivated inside this frail body an indomitable soul and a determined mind that overcame his physical limitations. It's a balance that everyone aspiring to sustained inner peace must strike. Mens sana in corpore sano, a strong mind in a strong body. Remember that when we say that someone showed so much heart, we don't mean emotion. We mean they had tenacity and grit. The metaphor is actually misleading if you think about it. It's really the spine, the backbone of the body that's doing the work. Young Churchill loved the written word, but diverging from the traditional path of a writer, he didn't lock himself up with books in a dusty old library. He put his body into action. Serving in or observing three straight wars, he made his name chronicling the exploits of the empire, first as a war correspondent in South Africa during the Boer War, where he was taken prisoner in 1899 and barely escaped with his life. In 1900, he was elected to his first political office. By age 33, realizing that greatness was impossible alone, he committed his body to another. He married his wife, Clementine, a brilliant, calming influence who balanced out many of his worst traits. It was one of the great marriages of the age. They called each other pug and cat, marked by true affection and love. My ability to persuade my wife to marry me, he said, was quite my most brilliant achievement. Of course, it would have been impossible for any ordinary man to have got through what I had to go through in peace and war without the devoted aid of what we call in England one's better half. As busy and ambitious as Churchill was, as much of a pusher as he was rarely frantic and did not tolerate disorganization. It almost ruins the fun to learn that Churchill's infamous bon mots and one-liners were in fact well-practiced and well-rehearsed. No one knew the effort that went into them, he said, nor the effort that went into making them look effortless. Every night, he said, I try myself by court-martial to see if I have done anything effective during the day. I don't just mean pawing the ground. Anyone can go through the motions, but something really effective. As a writer, he was gaspingly productive. While holding political office, Churchill managed to publish 7 books between 1898 and the end of World War I alone. How did he do it? How did he manage to pull so much out of himself? The simple answer, physical routine. Each morning, Churchill got up around 8 and took his first bath, which he entered at 98 degrees and had cranked up to 104 while he sat and occasionally somersaulted in the water. Freshly bathed, he would spend the next 2 hours reading. Then he responded to his daily mail, mostly pertaining to his political duties. Around noon, he'd stop in to say hello to his wife for the first time, believing all his life that the secret to a happy marriage was that spouses should not see each other before noon. Then he tackled whatever writing project he was working on, likely an article or a speech or a book. By early afternoon, he would be writing at a fantastic clip and then abruptly stop for lunch, which he would finally dress for. After lunch, he would go for a walk around Chartwell, his estate in the English countryside, feeding his swans and fish, to him the most important and enjoyable part of the day. Then he would sit on the porch and take in the air, thinking and musing. For inspiration and serenity, he might recite poetry to himself. At 3 p.m., it was time for a 2-hour nap. After the nap, it was family time and then a second bath before a late, seated, and formal dinner. After 8 p.m., after dinner and drinks, one more writing sprint before bed. It was a routine he would stick to even on Christmas. Churchill was a hard worker and a man of discipline, but like us, he was not perfect. He often worked more than he should have, usually because he spent more money than he needed to, and it produced a fair amount of writing that would have better remained unpublished. Churchill was impetuous, liked to gamble, and was prone to overcommit. It wasn't from the tireless execution of his wartime duties that he was inspired to depict himself once in a drawing as a pig carrying a 20,000-pound weight. It was his indulgences that produced that. Nor was his life an endless series of triumphs. Churchill made many mistakes, usually lapses of judgment that came from a mind fried by stress. Thus, he emerged from World War I with a mixed record. His service in the wartime administration had been marked by some major failures, but he had redeemed himself by resigning and serving on the front lines with the Royal Scots Fusiliers. After the war, he was called back to serve as Secretary of State for War and Air, and then Secretary of State for the Colonies. The mid-1920s saw Churchill serving as Chancellor of the Exchequer, a position in which he was in way over his head, while also having signed a contract to produce a 6-volume, 3,000-page account of the war titled The World Crisis. Left to his own devices, he might have tried to white-knuckle this incredible workload. But those around him saw the toll that his responsibilities were taking and, worried about burnout, urged him to find a hobby that might offer him a modicum of pleasure and enjoyment and rest. Do remember what I said about resting from current problems, Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin wrote to him. A big year will soon begin, and much depends on your keeping fit. In typical Churchillian fashion, he chose an unexpected form of leisure, bricklaying. Taught the craft by 2 employees at Chartwell, he immediately fell in love with the slow, methodical process of mixing mortar, troweling, and stacking bricks. Unlike his other professions, writing and politics, bricklaying didn't wear his body down. It invigorated him. Churchill could lay as many as 90 bricks in an hour. As he wrote to the Prime Minister in 1927, I have had a delightful month building a cottage and dictating a book, 200 bricks and 2,000 words a day. He also spent several hours a day on his ministerial duties. A friend observed how good it was for Churchill to get down on the ground and interact with the earth. This was also precious time he spent with his youngest daughter, Sarah, who dutifully carried the bricks for her father as his cute and well-loved apprentice. A dark moment in World War I had inspired another hobby, oil painting. He was introduced to it by his sister-in-law, who, sensing that Churchill was a steaming kettle of stress, handed him a small kit of paints and brushes her young children liked to play with. In a little book titled Painting as a Pastime, Churchill spoke eloquently of a reliance on new activities that use other parts of our minds and bodies to relieve the areas where we are overworked. The cultivation of a hobby and new forms of interest is therefore a policy of first importance to a public man, he wrote. To be really happy and really safe, one ought to have at least 2 or 3 hobbies, and they must all be real. Churchill was not a particularly good painter. His bricklaying was often corrected by professionals too, but even a glance at his pictures reveals how much he enjoyed himself as he worked. It's palpable in the brushstrokes. Just to paint is great fun, he would say. The colors are lovely to look at and delicious to squeeze out. Early on, Churchill was advised by a well-known painter never to hesitate in front of the canvas, that is to say, overthink, and he took it to heart. He wasn't intimidated or discouraged by his lack of skill. Only this could explain the audacity it took for him to add a mouse to a priceless Peter Paul Rubens painting that hung in one of the prime minister's residences. Painting was about expression of joy for Churchill. It was leisure, not work. Painting, like all good hobbies, taught the practitioner to be present. This heightened sense of observation of nature, he wrote, is one of the chief delights that have come to me through trying to paint. He had lived for 40 years on planet Earth, consumed by his work and his ambition, but through painting, his perspective and perception grew much sharper. Forced to slow down, to set up his easel, to mix his paints, to wait for them to dry, he saw things he would have previously blown right past. This was a skill that he actively cultivated, increasing his mental awareness by way of physical exercises. Churchill started going to museums to look at paintings. Then he'd wait a day and try to recreate them from memory. Or he'd try to capture a landscape he had seen after he had left it. This was similar to his habit of reciting poetry aloud. Painting challenged his intellect, appealed to his sense of beauty and proportion, unleashed his creative impulse, and brought him peace, remarked his lifelong friend Violet Bonham Carter. It was also, she said, the only thing Churchill ever did silently. His other daughter, Mary, observed that painting and manual labor were the sovereign antidotes to the depressive element in his nature. Churchill was happy because he got out of his own head and put his body to work. How necessary this turned out to be, because in 1929, his stunning political career suddenly came to what appeared to be an ignominious end. Driven from political life, Churchill spent a decade in pseudo-exile at Chartwell while Neville Chamberlain and a generation of British politicians appeased the growing threat of fascism in Europe. Life does that to us. It kicks our ass. Everything we work for can be taken away. All our powers can be rendered impotent in a moment. What follows this is not just an issue of spirit or of the mind, it's a real physical question. What do you do with your time? How do you handle the stress of the whiplash? Marcus Aurelius's answer was that in these situations, one must love the discipline you know and let it support you. In 1915, reeling from the failure of the Gallipoli campaign, Churchill wrote of feeling like a sea beast, fished up from the depths, or a diver too suddenly hoisted. My veins threatened to burst from the fall in pressure. I had great anxiety and no means of relieving it. I had vehement convictions and small power to give effect to them. It was then that he had picked up painting, and in 1929, experiencing a similar loss in cabin pressure, he returned to his discipline and his hobbies for relief and reflection. Churchill didn't know it in the middle of the 1930s, but being out of power during Germany's rearmament was exactly the right place to be. It would take real strength to stay there, to not fight his way back in. But if he had, he would have been sullied by the incompetence of his peers in the government. Churchill was likely one of the only British leaders to take the time to sit and read through and digest Hitler's Mein Kampf. If Chamberlain had, perhaps Hitler would have been stopped sooner. This time allowed Churchill to actively pursue his writing and radio careers, which made him a beloved celebrity in America and primed the country for its eventual alliance with Britain. He spent time with his goldfish and his children and his oils. Also, he had to wait, for the first time in his life, excepting those afternoons on the porch, he had to do nothing. Would Churchill have been the outsider called back to lead Britain in its finest hour had he allowed the indignity of his political exile to overwhelm his mind, burrow into his soul, and compel him to fight his way back into the limelight in those years? Could he have had the energy and strength at age 66 to put the country on his back and lead without that supposedly lost decade if he had kept up his breakneck pace? Almost certainly not. Churchill himself would write that every prophet must be forced into the wilderness, where they undergo solitude, deprivation, reflection, and meditation. It's from this physical ordeal, he said, that psychic dynamite is made. When Churchill was recalled, he was ready. He was rested. He could see what no one else could or would. Everyone else cowered in fear of Hitler, but Churchill did not. Instead, he fought. He stood alone. As he said to the House of Commons, "Even though large tracts of Europe and many old and famous states have fallen or may fall into the grip of the Gestapo and all the odious apparatus of Nazi rule, we shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the New World, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old." Churchill demanded equal courage from those in his own house. When asked by his daughter-in-law what they could possibly do if the Germans invaded Britain, he growled and replied, "You can always get a carving knife from the kitchen and take one with you, can't you?" The British Empire had been responsible for despicable human rights violations, but Churchill knew irredeemable evil when he saw it, and its name was Nazism. Concentration camps and genocidal extermination still lay off in the future, but Churchill knew that no self-respecting leader, no country of virtue could make a deal with Hitler. Even if that was easier, even if it might have protected Britain from invasion. At the same time, he was careful to manage the passions that war stirs up. "I hate nobody except Hitler," he said, "and that is professional." Churchill was an indefatigable workhorse from the day Britain declared war on Germany in 1939 until the end of the war in mid-1945. During the war, Clementine designed a special suit her husband could wear and sleep in. They were called his siren suits, though the British public endearingly referred to them as his rompers, and they saved him precious minutes getting dressed, allowing him to grab much-needed naps. So yes, he was out of balance in those years, working 110-hour weeks and hardly ever still. It has been estimated that he traveled 110,000 miles by air and sea and car between 1940 and 1943 alone. During the war, it was said that Churchill kept less schedule than a forest fire and had less peace than a hurricane. But then again, he'd rested up for precisely this moment. And when it was an option, he did maintain his routine, even when he was living like a gopher in the underground bunker that was the cabinet war rooms. He didn't have much time for painting during the war, nor many chances to be out in nature, but when he could, he did. One is a beautiful painting of a North African sunset, which he drove an extra 5 hours to capture after the major war powers met at Casablanca. It is unlikely that any single individual has ever done more to save or advance the notion sacred to Eastern or Western civilization. And how was Churchill rewarded for these labors, for all that he had done? In 1945, he was pushed out of office. Upon hearing the news, Clementine attempted to console him by saying, "Perhaps this is a blessing in disguise." "It must be very well disguised," Churchill replied. He was wrong, she was right, as usual. Not only because it allowed Churchill to write his final set of memoirs, The Second World War, which firmly established and taught the lessons that have prevented the world from veering towards suicide since, but because it allowed him once again to rest up and balance himself. We can see photos of him painting in Marrakesh in 1948, in the south of France in the 1950s. In all, he would paint some 550 paintings in his lifetime, 145 of them after the war. It was, in the end, a life of much struggle and sacrifice, a lot of it thankless and misunderstood. It was productive, but at a high personal cost. The same tasks and responsibilities would have burned out and burned through a dozen normal people. Was it worth it? A wearied hero had asked in Churchill's only novel. The struggle, the labor, the constant rush of affairs, the sacrifice of so many things that make life easy or pleasant, for what? He wrote that when he was young, when he had been busy and ambitious, but had not yet truly engaged in public service. In the future lay 55 years in Parliament, 31 years as a minister, and 9 years as Prime Minister. The years ahead would show him the true meaning of life and what it meant to really fight for causes that mattered. He experienced both triumph and disaster, and by the end of his life he came to know that it was all worth it, and certainly all of us alive today are grateful for those labors. Indeed, Churchill's last words were confirmation of this fact. "The journey has been enjoyable and well worth making. Once." Epicurus said that the wise will accomplish three things in their life: leave written works behind them, be financially prudent and provide for the future, and cherish country living. That is to say, we will be reflective, we will be responsible and moderate, and we will find time to relax in nature. It cannot be said that Churchill did not do these things well, even granting that he did live it up when he could afford to. We compare this description to the three words Aristotle used to describe the lives of slaves in his time: work, punishment, and food. Which of these are we closer to in the modern world? Which of these is the path to happiness and stillness? No one can afford to neglect the final domain in our journey to stillness: what we do with our bodies, what we put in our bodies, where we dwell, what kind of routine and schedule we keep, how we find leisure and relief from the pressures of life. If we are to be half as productive as Churchill and manage to capture the same joy and zest and stillness that defined his life, there are traits we will need to cultivate. Each of us will need to rise above our physical limitations, find hobbies that rest and replenish us, develop a reliable, disciplined routine, spend time getting active outdoors, seek out solitude and perspective, learn to sit, to do nothing when called for, get enough sleep and rein in our workaholism, commit to causes bigger than ourselves. As they say, the body keeps score. If we don't take care of ourselves physically, if we don't align ourselves properly, it doesn't matter how strong we are mentally or spiritually. This will take effort because we will not simply think our way to peace. We can't pray our soul into better condition. We've got to move and live our way there. It will take our body, our habits, our actions, our rituals, our self-care to get our mind and our spirit in the right place, just as it takes our mind and spirit to get our body to the right place. It's a trinity, a holy one, each part dependent on the others. Say no. The advantages of non-action, few in the world attain these. The Tao Te Ching. When Fabius was dispatched to lead the Roman legions against Hannibal, he did nothing. He did not attack. He did not race out to drive the terrifying invader out of Italy and back to Africa. You might think that this was a sign of weakness. Certainly most of Rome did. But in fact, it was all part of Fabius's strategy. Hannibal was far from home. He was losing men to the elements and could not easily replace them. Fabius believed that if Rome just held out and did not engage in costly battles, they would win. But the mob couldn't handle that kind of deliberate restraint. "We are the strongest army in the world," his critic said. "We don't sit around doing nothing when someone tries to attack us." So while Fabius was away attending a religious ceremony, they pressured one of his commanders to attack. It did not go well. He ran straight into a trap. Fabius had to rush to his rescue, and even then this commander was hailed as a hero for doing something, while Fabius was labeled a coward for holding himself back. When his term ended, the Roman assemblies voted to abandon what is now known as a Fabian strategy of mostly avoiding battle and wearing Hannibal down in favor for greater aggression and more action. It didn't work. Only after the bloodbath at the Battle of Cannae, in which the Romans attacked Hannibal and lost nearly their entire army in a horrific rout, did people finally begin to understand Fabius's wisdom. Now they could see that what had looked like an excess of caution was in fact a brilliant method of warfare. He had been buying time and giving his opponent a chance to destroy himself. Only now, and not a moment too soon, were they ready to listen to him. While most great Romans were given honorific titles that highlighted their great victories or accomplishments in foreign lands, Fabius was later given one that stands out. Fabius Cunctator, the Delayer. He was special for what he didn't do, for what he waited to do, and has stood as an important example to all leaders since, especially the ones feeling pressure from themselves or their followers to be bold or take immediate action. In baseball, you make a name for yourself by swinging for the fences, particularly for players from small, poor countries. Showing your power as a home run hitter is how you get noticed by scouts and coaches. As they say in the Dominican Republic, you don't walk off the island, meaning you hit your way off. It's like life. You can't benefit from opportunities you don't try to take advantage of. But Dr. Jonathan Fader, an elite sports psychologist who has spent nearly a decade with the New York Mets, has talked about just how problematic this lesson is for rookie players in the majors. They built their reputations and therefore their identities on swinging at every pitch they thought they could hit. And now they're facing the best pitchers in the world. Suddenly, aggression is a weakness, not a strength. Now they have to get up there in front of millions of people getting paid millions of dollars and mostly not swing the bat. They have to wait for the perfect pitch. What they have to learn, what the great hitter Sadaharu Oh himself learned in a series of complicated batting exercises demanded by his Zen master and hidden coach was the power of waiting and the power of precision, the power of void. Because that's what makes for a real pro. A truly great hitter, not just a swinger, needs quick hands and powerful hips, to be sure, but they must also possess the power of wu wei, or non-action. Wu wei is the ability to hold the bat back, waiting until the batter sees the perfect pitch. It is the yogi in meditation. They're physically still so they can be active on a mental and spiritual level. That was also Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It might have seemed like he wasn't doing enough, that he wasn't rushing to destroy his opponent, but he was rightly carving out the space and time to think, and time and space for the Russians to do the same thing. Practicing Wu Wei was precisely what Tiger Woods lost the ability to do as his work and sex addictions took control. A disciplined action. That's what John Cage called doing nothing in the performance instructions on 433. You don't solve a maze by rushing through. You have to stop and think. You have to walk slowly and carefully, reining in your energy. Otherwise, you'll get hopelessly lost. The same is true for the problems we face in life. The green light is a powerful symbol in our culture. We forget what Mr. Rogers was trying to make us see, that the yellow light and the red light are just as important. Slow down. Stop. One recent study found that subjects would rather give themselves an electric shock than experience boredom for even a few minutes. Then we wonder why people do so many stupid things. There is a haunting clip of Joan Rivers, well into her 70s, already one of the most accomplished and respected and talented comedians of all time, in which she is asked why she keeps working, why she is always on the road, always looking for more gigs. Telling the interviewer about the fear that drives her, she holds up an empty calendar. If my book ever looked like this, it would mean that nobody wants me and that everything I ever tried to do in my life didn't work. Nobody cared, and I've been totally forgotten. It's not just that there was never enough for Joan. It's that our best and most lasting work comes when we take things slow, when we pick our shots and wait for the right pitches. Somebody who thinks they're nothing and doesn't matter because they're not doing something for even a few days is depriving themselves of stillness, yes, but they are also closing themselves off from a higher plane of performance that comes out of it. Spiritually, that's hard. Physically, that's harder still. You have to make yourself say no. You have to make yourself not take the stage. A weaker Fabius would not have been able to resist attacking Hannibal, and all of history might have turned out differently. A long-distance runner who can't pace himself, a money manager who can't wait out a bear market. If they can't learn the art of Wu Wei in their professions, they won't succeed. If you can't do it in your life, forget about your success. You'll burn out your body, and you don't get another one of those. We should look fearfully, even sympathetically, at the people who have become slaves to their calendars, who require a staff of 10 to handle their ongoing projects, whose lives seem to resemble a fugitive fleeing one scene for the next. There is no stillness there. It's servitude. Each of us needs to get better at saying no. As in, no, sorry, I'm not available. No, sorry, that sounds great, but I'd rather not. No, I'm going to wait and see. No, I don't like that idea. No, I don't need that. I'm going to make the most of what I have. No, because if I said yes to you, I'd have to say yes to everyone. Maybe it's not the most virtuous thing to say, no, sorry, I can't, when you really can, but just don't want to. But can you really afford to do it? And does it not harm other people if you're constantly stretched too thin? A pilot gets to say, sorry, I'm on standby, as an excuse to get out of things. Doctors and firemen and police officers get to use being on call as a shield. But are we not on call in our own lives? Isn't there something or someone that we're preserving our full capacities for? Are our own bodies not on call for our families, for our self-improvement, for our own work? Always think about what you're really being asked to give, because the answer is often a piece of your life, usually in exchange for something you don't even want. Remember, that's what time is. It's your life. It's your flesh and blood that you can never get back. In every situation, ask, what is it? Why does it matter? Do I need it? Do I want it? What are the hidden costs? Will I look back from the distant future and be glad I did it? If I never knew about it at all, if the request was lost in the mail, if they hadn't been able to pin me down and ask me, would I even notice that I missed out? When we know what to say no to, we can say yes to the things that matter. Take a walk. It is only ideas gained from walking that have any worth. Friedrich Nietzsche. Nearly every morning, the citizens of Copenhagen were treated to the strange sight of Soren Kierkegaard walking the streets. The cantankerous philosopher would write in the morning at a standing desk, and then around noon would head out onto the busy streets of the city. He walked on the newfangled sidewalks that had been built for fashionable citizens to stroll along. He walked through the city's parks and along the pathways of Assistens Cemetery, where he would later be buried. On occasion, he walked out past the city's walls and into the countryside. Kierkegaard never seemed to walk straight. He zigged and zagged, crossing the street without notice, trying to always remain in the shade. When he had either worn himself out, worked through what he was struggling with, or been struck with a good idea, he would turn around and make for home, where he would write for the rest of the day. Seeing Kierkegaard out walking surprised the residents of Copenhagen, because he seemed, at least from his writings, to be such a high-strung individual. They weren't wrong. Walking was how he released the stress and frustration that his philosophical explorations inevitably created. In a beautiful letter to his sister-in-law, who was often bedridden and depressed as a result, Kierkegaard wrote of the importance of walking. Above all, he told her in 1847, do not lose your desire to walk. Every day I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away from every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it. Kierkegaard believed that sitting still was a kind of breeding ground for illness, but walking, movement, to him was almost sacred. It cleansed the soul and cleared the mind in a way that primed his explorations as a philosopher. Life is a path, he liked to say, we have to walk it. And while Kierkegaard was particularly eloquent in his writing about walking, he was by no means alone in his dedication to the practice, nor alone in reaping the benefits. Nietzsche said that the ideas in Thus Spoke Zarathustra came to him on a long walk. Nikola Tesla discovered the rotating magnetic field, one of the most important scientific discoveries of all time, on a walk through a city park in Budapest in 1882. When he lived in Paris, Ernest Hemingway would take long walks along the quay, whenever he was stuck in his writing and needed to clarify his thinking. Charles Darwin's daily schedule included several walks, as did those of Steve Jobs and the groundbreaking psychologist Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman, the latter of whom wrote that I did my best thinking of my life on leisurely walks with Amos. It was the physical activity in the body, Kahneman wrote, that got his brain going. When Martin Luther King was a seminary student at Crozier, he took an hour walk each day through the campus woods to commune with nature. Walt Whitman and Ulysses S. Grant often bumped into each other on their respective walks around Washington, which cleared their minds and helped them think. Perhaps it was that experience that Whitman was writing about in this verse of Song of Myself. Knowest thou the joys of pensive thought? Joys of the free and lonesome heart, the tender, gloomy heart. Joys of the solitary walk, the spirit bowed yet proud, the suffering and the struggle. Freud was known for his speedy walks around Vienna after his evening meal. The composer Gustav Mahler spent as much as 4 hours a day walking, using his time to work through and jot down ideas. Ludwig von Beethoven carried sheet music and a writing utensil with him on walks for the same reason. Dorothy Day was a lifelong walker, and it was on her strolls along the beach on Staten Island in the 1920s that she first began to feel a strong sense of God in her life and the first flickerings of the awakening that would put her on a path towards sainthood. It's probably not a coincidence that Jesus himself was a walker, a traveler who knew the pleasures and the divineness, putting one foot in front of the other. How does walking get us closer to stillness? Isn't the whole point of what we're talking about to reduce activity, not to seek it out? Yes, we are in motion when we walk, but it is not frenzied motion or even conscious motion. It is repetitive, ritualized motion. It is deliberate. It is an exercise in peace. The Buddhists talk of walking meditation, where the movement after a long session of sitting, particularly movement through a beautiful setting, can unlock a different kind of stillness than traditional meditation. Indeed, forest bathing and most natural beauty can only be accomplished by getting out of your house or office or car and trekking out into the woods on foot. The key to a good walk is to be aware, to be present and open to the experience. Put your phone away. Put the pressing problems of your life away, or rather let them melt away as you move. Look down at your feet. What are they doing? Notice how effortlessly they move. Is it you who's doing that?